7. Fall of Songs. Bright is the ring of words when the right man rings them. Fair the fall of songs when the singer sings them. Robert Louis Stevenson. Bright is the ring of words. You have to understand, said Charles, his eyes glittering earnestly. The enclave is extremely annoyed with you, James. Some of them, I would even say, are angry. It was the morning after his odd visit to Chiswick. James was sitting in the chair in front of his father's desk. Tessa had never redecorated the Institute's office, and it still had a dark Victorian feel to it, with pine-coloured wallpaper and Aubusson rugs on the floors. The chair his father sat in was heavy mahogany, the armrests chipped and scratched. Charles Fairchild leaned against the wall near the door, which he had shut and locked after the three of them. His red hair gleamed like a dull old penny in the witchlight. Lucy had been swept away by Tessa after breakfast to help in the infirmary. The silent brothers had put Barbara, Piers, and Ariadne into deep, unwavering, enchanted sleep. They had hopes that their bodies would resist the poison while they rested. One could sense the shadow in the house, the sickroom atmosphere, along with the thick tension in this room. That seems like it must be very upsetting for the enclave, then, said James. Bad for their dyspepsia. He was trying not to glare at Charles, but was losing the battle. He'd slept badly the night before after returning to the Institute with his father. It would have been one thing if his father had been angry, but it was clear Will had been more worried than anything else, and James's insistence that he'd merely gone for a walk and ended up in Chiswick didn't help matters. You need to take this seriously, James, said Charles. It was necessary to use a tracking rune to find you. I wouldn't say it was necessary, said James. I was not in need of help, nor was I lost. James, his father said calmly, you disappeared. I should have told you I was going out, said James, but demons attacked us in daylight yesterday. We still have 3 shadow hunters in the infirmary and no cure for their condition. Why is the enclave focused on me? Red flared in Charles's face. The enclave is meeting to discuss the situation with the demons today. But we're shadow hunters. Life doesn't simply stop because of a demon attack. According to Tatiana, you went to her house last night and demanded to see Grace, and when she said no, you smashed her greenhouse to pieces. Will threw up his hands. Why would James vandalize a random outbuilding because he couldn't see a girl? It's ridiculous, Charles, and you know it. James half closed his eyes. He didn't want to look directly at his father and see Will's distress, his tie askew and his jacket rumpled, and his face showing the evidence of a sleepless night. I told you, Charles, I never spoke to Mrs. Blackthorne or Grace either. And there was a Cerberus demon in that greenhouse. Maybe so, said Charles. He was beginning to remind James of a dog that refused to give up a shoe it was gnawing on. But you would never have been in a position to see it had you not already been on the grounds of Chiswick House and broken into the greenhouse. I didn't break into the greenhouse, said James, which was technically true. Then tell me what you did do. Charles pounded his right fist into the palm of his other hand. If what Tatiana is saying isn't true, then why don't you tell me what did happen? James thought, I went into the Shadow Realm to see if I could find a connection to the demon attacks. I followed a light I believe was Cortana and discovered myself in the greenhouse, where Cordelia Carstairs was already being attacked by a tentacle. No, no one would believe him. And they would think he was mad. And he would be getting Cordelia and Matthew and Lucy and Thomas and Christopher into trouble as well. Silent, James gritted his teeth. Charles sighed. You leave us to assume the worst, James. That he's a senseless vandal? Honestly, Charles, said Will. You know how Tatiana feels about our family. I killed a demon in that greenhouse, James said evenly. I did what I was supposed to do. Yet I am the one the Enclave is blaming, rather than the Shadow Hunter keeping a demon on the grounds of her house. It was Will's turn to sigh. Jamie, we know that Benedict kept Cerberus demons. The one that was there, and I do believe you when you say it was there, cannot be blamed on Tatiana, said Charles. The rest of the property has been searched and there were no more. It was your bad luck to stumble across this one. That greenhouse is full of dark magic plants, said James. Surely someone noticed that. It is, Charles admitted. But given the severity of her complaints, James, no one is going to notice the presence of a few belladonna bushes in her shrubbery. You still wouldn't have run across the demon if you hadn't been trespassing already. Tell Tatiana we'll pay for the repairs to the greenhouse, said Will wearily. I must say all this seems a vast overreaction, Charles. James happened to be there, he ran into a demon and things took their natural course. Would you rather he'd let it loose to devour the neighbourhood? Charles cleared his throat. Let us stick to practicalities. Sometimes James had a hard time remembering that Charles was a shadow hunter and not one of the thousands of bowler-hatted, sack-suited bankers who flooded down Fleet Street every morning on their way to offices in the city. I have had a long conversation with Bridgestock this morning. Will said something rude in Welsh. However you may feel about him, he remains the Inquisitor, said Charles. And at the moment, with my mother in Idris dealing with the Elias Carstairs situation, I represent her interests here in London. When the Inquisitor speaks, I must hear him out. James started. He had not connected Charlotte's trip to Idris with the situation affecting Cordelia's father. He supposed he should have. He recalled overhearing his sister and Cordelia in Kensington Gardens. Cordelia saying her father had made a mistake, the tremble in her voice. No punishment is being recommended for James at this point, Charles went on. But James, I suggest you avoid Chiswick House. And avoid Tatiana Blackthorne and her daughter entirely. James went still. The hands of the grandfather clock were blades, sweeping slowly around the face, cutting time. Let me apologize to her, James said. The silver bracelet felt as if it were burning on his wrist. He didn't know if he meant Tatiana or Grace. Now, James, Charles said, you should not try to make a young woman choose between you and her family. It is not kind. Grace told me herself that if she were to marry a man not of her mother's choosing, she would be disowned. You barely know her, James snapped. One carriage ride. I know her better than you think, said Charles, with a flash of schoolboy superiority. Are you two talking about the same girl? Said Will, his eyebrows raising. Grace Blackthorne. I don't see. It's nothing. Nothing. James could stand it no longer. He rose, buttoning his jacket. I must be off, he said. There's an orangery in Kensington Gardens that needs smashing. Ladies, look up your outbuildings. James Herondale is in town and he has been slighted in love. Charles looked pained. James, he said. But James had already swept past him and out of the room, slamming the door behind him. Cordelia plucked nervously at the fabric of her visiting gown. Quite surprisingly, an official invitation to tea from Anna Lightwood, on monogrammed stationery no less, had arrived by penny post that morning. Cordelia was shocked that after everything that had happened, Anna had remembered her desultory offer. Still, she had seized at the opportunity to get out of the house like a drowning man seizing a rope. She'd barely been able to sleep after getting home the night before. Curled under her coverlet, she couldn't help thinking of Cousin Jem and her father, and helplessly of James, the way he'd been gentle with her ankle, the look on his face when he talked about the shadow realm that only he could see. She couldn't think of a way to help him, any more than she could help her father. She wondered if not being able to help the people you loved was the worst feeling in the world. Then, at lunch, her mother and Alistair had occupied themselves by trading the latest gossip. Raziel knew where they'd found it out, that James had been discovered wandering about Tatiana Blackthorne's gardens, having merrily smashed in all her windows, and terrified her and her daughter by racing drunkenly about her lawn. Even Risa looked amused as she refilled the teapot. Cordelia was horrified. "That is not what happened." "And how would you know?" said Alistair, sounding a bit as if he knew exactly why she did. But he couldn't have guessed, could he? Cordelia couldn't be sure. Alistair often seemed as if he knew a great deal more than he was letting on. She thought longingly of the distant past, when the two of them had been able to settle their differences by hitting each other over the head with toy tea kettles. So, thank goodness for tea with Anna, even if she had nothing decent to wear. Cordelia cast a last glance at herself in the pier glass between the vestibule windows. While her apple-green princess dress with pink embroidery was fashionable and pretty, all the flounces made her resemble an old-fashioned lamp, and her face above the lace collar looked jaundiced. With a sigh, Cordelia caught up her gloves and reticule from the hall table and headed toward the door. "Cordelia?" Sonar hurried toward her, the heels of her boots click-clicking on the parquet floor. "Where are you going?" "To take tea with Anna Lightwood," said Cordelia. "She invited me yesterday." "That's what your brother said, but I didn't credit it." "I want you to make friends, Leila." Sonar rarely used Cordelia's pet name, given to her by Sonar, after the heroine of the poem they both loved, unless she was worried. "You know that I do, but I am not sure you should visit Miss Lightwood." Cordelia felt her back stiffen. Alistair had come to observe the conversation between his sister and mother. He was leaning against the doorway to the breakfast room, smirking. "I accepted the invitation," she said. "I will go." "At the ball the other night, I overheard much talk about Anna Lightwood," said Sonar, "and none of it was complimentary. There are those in the enclave who see her as improper and brash. We have come here to make friends and form alliances, not to alienate the powerful. Are you certain she is the best choice for a social call?"
"She seems proper enough."
Cordelia reached for her new straw hat, decorated with a silk posy and ribbons. Alistair spoke from the doorway. "There may be those in the older generation who disapprove of Anna, but in our set she is one of the most popular shadow hunters in London. It would be unwise for Cordelia to turn down her invitation."
"Really?"
Sonar looked curious.
"Can that be true?"
"It is." Alistair pushed back a lock of his pale hair. Cordelia could remember when his hair had been black as a crow's wing before he'd started dyeing it. "Anna's uncle is the head of the institute. Her godmother is the consul. Without a question, the most prominent families to know in London are the Herondales, the Lightwoods, and the Fairchilds, and Anna is tied to all of them."
"Very well," said Sonar after a pause. "But Alistair, you go with her. Pay a short call and observe the proprieties. Afterward, if you like, the two of you can go shopping in Leadenhall Market."
Cordelia half expected a protest from Alistair, but he only shrugged. "As you say, Mother," he said, brushing past Cordelia on his way to the door. He was already dressed to go out, Cordelia thought with mingled surprise and amusement, in a deep grey flannel coat that suited his dark eyes. The shape of his weapons belt was just visible beneath the line of his coat. The enclave had suggested that all shadow hunters arm themselves as a precaution when going out, even in daylight. Cordelia herself had Cortana strapped to her back, glamoured so that it would be invisible to mundanes. Perhaps Alistair really did know more than he was letting on. The late afternoon sun shone brightly on Grosvenor Square, as Matthew's father, Henry,
answered the door at the consul's house. James ceased what he suspected might have been overly loud knocking as the door swung open. Henry smiled when he saw James. He had a plain but kindly face, ginger hair that had faded to brown streaked with grey, and a hint of Matthew's grin. Come in, James, he said, rolling backward. He had been terribly injured 25 years ago in the Battle of Cader Idris, and he had never walked again. He had taken a standard bath chair for invalids and bent his inventive spirit upon it. It was fitted now with a smaller version of the wheels one might find on an automobile. A curved appendage with an electric light hung over one of Henry's shoulders. Over the other shoulder, a clawed attachment allowed him to reach for objects placed high overhead. A shelf beneath the seat carried books. Christopher adored his godfather and spent many hours in Henry's laboratory, working on all sorts of inventions as well as improvements to the bath chair. Some had been very useful, like the steam-powered elevator they had installed so that Henry could easily reach his cellar laboratory. Others, like Henry and Christopher's attempt to create a demon-repelling ointment, had not. Henry had a kind spirit, and had welcomed James as Matthew's para-bataille, even before the two of them had gone through the ceremony in the Silent City. "Matthew's in the back garden," he said now, his eyes crinkling at the corners. He said something about reading a book surrounded by the uncritical beauties of nature. James had to concede this did sound like Matthew. Is he alone? Unless you count Oscar. Oscar Wilde was Matthew's dog, who James had found wandering on the streets of London and presented to Matthew. The dog adored Matthew uncritically, much like the beauties of nature. James cleared his throat. There was something I found, an odd sort of dirt. I wondered if you could take a look at it for me. You know, in your laboratory. Most people would have treated this as a strange request. Not Henry Fairchild. His eyes lit up. Indeed. Give it here. James passed over the small vial of dirt he had filled from the contents of his pocket the night before. I shall take a look at this as soon as possible. I am leaving soon to see Charlotte in Idris, but I shan't be gone too long. Henry winked at James and rolled away toward the lift that would take him to the laboratory. James made his way past the drawing room, dining room, kitchen, where he bowed to the cook, who waved a spoon at him, in greeting or threat, he wasn't sure, and out through the back door which led to the garden. He and Matthew had spent hours training there. It was a welcoming square green space with a massive London plane tree at its centre. Matthew was standing in its shade reading a book. He was absorbed enough that he didn't hear the door shut or notice James coming toward him across the grass until James had nearly reached him. He looked up and his green eyes widened. "James," he said, and the word sounded like an exhale of relief. He quickly schooled his face into a frown. "I don't know whether to embrace you as a brother or strike you down as a foe." "I vote the first one," said James. "I suppose it isn't really fair to be angry about last night," Matthew mused. "I imagine you have very little control over what happens when you go into the Shadow Realm. But once your father had finished shouting at us all in Welsh for breaking his window and letting you leave, the news came through that they tracked you to Chiswick House, and I did wonder." "Wonder what?" James perched himself on the arm of a white garden bench. "Whether you'd use the Shadow Realm to go and see Grace," said Matthew. "I mean, what else is there in Chiswick? Nothing interesting." "I didn't go there voluntarily," said James. "Then tell me what happened," said Matthew, tucking his novel into the crook of a tree. "Actually, wait." He held up a hand just as James had started to speak. "Wait, wait. I shall murder you if this keeps up," said James. Matthew grinned, and there was the sound of barking. Boisterous hellos bounced off the garden walls. Thomas and Christopher, having paused to greet a tail-wagging Oscar, were running down the back steps of the house. "James!" Christopher called as they got closer. What happened last night? Where'd you disappear to?
There you go, James, Matthew said smugly. Now you don't have to tell the story more than once.
Yes, what happened to you last night? Said Thomas. You just vanished, you know. Matthew was about to rip the Institute apart, brick by brick, to see if you'd fallen into the crypt, when your father tracked you to Chiswick.
Why Chiswick? Christopher wondered aloud. Nothing interesting happens there.
It has now, said Matthew cheerfully.
Before the conversation could degenerate further, James explained how he had gone into the world of shadows, how he had followed a light and found himself in the greenhouse. He described the warped Cerberus demon and how he had killed it. When he got to the part about Lucy and Cordelia, Matthew began to look less cheerful.
What on earth were they doing there? He said.
They'd gone to check on Miss Blackthorne and see if she was all right, said James, who wasn't sure he believed this particular story himself. Lucy had had her bright-eyed storytelling face on. As for Cordelia, he realised with a slight jolt that he doubted he'd be able to tell if she was lying to him or not. He didn't know her that well, though he felt as if he ought to.
Seems dangerous to be out and about at night after those attacks, said Matthew. Lucy, the girls, shouldn't be taking such risks.
As if you're going to stop going out at night, Thomas pointed out. He and Christopher had sprawled on the grass while James was talking.
Matthew was leaning against the plane tree, absently stroking Oscar's head.
Here's my question. Why Lightwood? I mean, Chiswick House. Why the greenhouse?
No idea, said James, keeping his thoughts about Cortana to himself. They were too vague and would only confuse things.
Perhaps because the demon was there?
Demons do like to take up residence in ruins, especially those where there are remnants of black magic, said Christopher. And we all know what Grandfather Benedict was up to in that house. It's why he turned into a worm.
Ah, said Matthew, fond family memories.
Well, the Clave agrees with you, said James. They believe the demon has been there since Benedict's time, and while it seems entirely unconnected to the attacks, I do feel we have been seeing an unusual number of demons lately in rather unusual places.
Demons in unusual places was Benedict's motto, said Matthew, tossing a stick for Oscar.
How do we know what the Clave thinks?
Charles has been remarkably tight-lipped.
Not to me, said James. He came to see me this morning. Thomas's expression darkened.
Don't tell me he believes all that poppycock about you going to see Miss Blackthorne and being refused.
He does believe it, said James, not wanting to hear the story again. He was already annoyed at himself for having let Charles get to him where Grace was concerned. Of course, Charles knew nothing significant about her. Or, at least, I was unable to give him another, better explanation. I cannot say I was wandering about the Shadow Realm. Better, I suppose, that they think I am a lunatic in love.
But you barely know Miss Blackthorne, said Christopher, nibbling a piece of grass.
James's eyes met Matthew's. Matthew was looking at him with sympathy, but there was a clear statement in his green eyes.
It's time.
I do know Grace, said James, and I do love her. He explained about the summers in Idris, Blackthorne Manor next door, and the hours he'd spent with Grace in Brosseland, painting pictures in words for her of London, the great city she had never seen. He explained that Tatiana Blackthorne loathed him, and spoke of Charles's admonition that he stay away from the Blackthorns. By the time he was done, the first stars were beginning to come out in the darkening sky. Christopher was the first to speak.
I didn't know that you were in love with someone, James. I'm sorry. I should have been paying attention.
I didn't know either, said Thomas, and I have been paying attention.
James said, I am sorry. I didn't tell you before. Grace is always worried that her mother would find out and be furious. Even Lucy does not know.
though he realized Cordelia did. It had not even seemed strange to tell her. Thomas was frowning.
My Aunt Tatiana is mad. My father has often said so, that his sister was driven to madness by what happened to her father and her husband. She blames our parents for their deaths.
But James has never done anything to her, said Christopher, his eyebrows knitting together.
He's a Herondale, said Thomas. That's enough.
That's ridiculous, Christopher said. It is as if one was bitten by a duck, and years later one shot a completely different duck and ate it for dinner and called that revenge.
Please do not use metaphors, Christopher, said Matthew. It gives me the pip.
This is bad enough without mentioning ducks, said James.
He had never fancied ducks since one had bitten him in Hyde Park as a small child.
I'm sorry, Thomas. I feel as if I have failed in helping Barbara.
No, Thomas said quickly. We have only just started.
I was thinking, perhaps you and I and Matthew should go to the Devil Tavern and look through the book collection. There are volumes there that the Clave will never find combing through the Institute's library. We could see if there is any mention of these daylight demon creatures.
What about Christopher? Said Matthew.
Christopher held up a vial filled with a red substance. I managed to acquire some blood that the Silent Brothers had taken from one of the patients last night, he said proudly. I intend to mix modern science and shadow hunter magic to attempt to create an antidote for the demon poison. Henry has said I can use his laboratory while he is in Idris.
Thomas squinted. That had better not be my sister's blood.
It's Piers's, said Christopher, though for the sake of pure science it should not matter.
And yet we are all relieved, said James. Matthew and I can go to Fleet Street. Perhaps Thomas should help Christopher in the lab.
Thomas sighed. I always end up helping Christopher in the lab.
It is because you are remarkably good at dodging explosions, said James. And also, you can curse in Spanish.
How does that help? Said Thomas.
It doesn't, said James. But Christopher likes it. Now,
James!
It was Henry calling from the house.
James sprinted away. Oscar had fallen asleep in the grass, his paws sticking up into the air. There was a short silence. Matthew took his book from the tree and brushed off the cover.
Grace, Thomas said finally. What is she like? I don't think we've exchanged two words.
Very shy, said Matthew. Very quiet. Looks painfully frightened a great deal of the time, yet always admired at social events.
That's odd, said Thomas.
Not really, said Christopher. Men like the idea of a woman they can rescue.
Both Matthew and Thomas looked at him in amazement. He shrugged.
I heard my mother say it once, he said. Seems true in this case.
Do you think she's in love with James? Said Thomas.
Because he seems gone on her. I hope it's not unrequited.
She had better love him back, said Matthew. He deserves it.
We don't always love people who deserve it, said Thomas quietly.
Maybe not, said Matthew, but often we don't love those who don't deserve it, and very right too.
His fingers gripped the book he held so tightly that they had gone pale.
Thomas put his finger to his lips. James had returned carrying a letter. The address had been written in a decidedly feminine hand. J.H., care of Matthew Fairchild. Urgent.
Someone sent you a letter here, said Thomas curiously.
Is it from Grace?
James, who had already scanned the first few lines, nodded.
She didn't want to risk getting me in hot water with the Enclave. She knew I'd either be here or Matthew would find me and deliver the message.
He was quite sure his friends had been talking about him while he was gone, but he didn't mind it. His relief at seeing Grace's writing felt like a palpable thing. The loops and scrolls of her hand were as familiar to him as the forest outside Herondale Manor.
So, what does she say? Said Matthew.
She adores your face and yearns to run her fingers through your messy raven hair. She wants me to meet her tonight, at 10, James said. He slipped the letter into his pocket, his mind racing. I had better go. I have no way to get a message back to her, and I'll have to walk. The streets are entirely snarled up with traffic.
You can't walk all the way to Chiswick, Thomas protested.
James shook his head. Of course not. She proposed a spot in London, a place Matthew and I used to do balancing exercises. I've described it to her before.
Still, Matthew looked hesitant, is it wise? My brother is an idiot, but if the Enclave wants you to stay away from the Blackthorns...
I must, said James, not wanting to explain. He knew his friends, and they would insist on coming with him if he did. Better to leave now and let them think his concern was a purely romantic one. He bent to rub Oscar's head and said, Thomas, Christopher, you handle the laboratory work. Matthew, I will find you when I return from meeting Grace, and we will go to the devil.
I am always going to the devil, said Matthew, a glint in his eye. I shall be at the tavern by midnight. Join me there when you can.
James excused himself and hurried from the house. The letter in his pocket seemed to beat against his chest like a second heart. Over and over he saw the last line Grace had written.
I shall wait there and pray that you come. Help me, James. I am in danger.
Alistair dropped Cordelia off at Anna's house with a perfunctory pat on the head and a promise to return just before 9 o'clock. Since their mother usually served dinner at 9, this seemed to Cordelia to be cutting it rather close, but he rattled off in the carriage before she could even ask him where he was going. She couldn't say she was entirely surprised. With a sigh, Cordelia turned to face Percy Street, a small side street near Tottenham Court Road. It was made up of long rows of houses of red brick that all looked very much the same. Each had sash windows, white-painted doors, brick chimneys, a shallow set of steps, and a fence about the servants' entrance made of black wrought iron. On the stairs in front of number 30, a girl sat crying. She was a very fashionable girl, in a walking dress of blue foulard, with lace trimmings and acres of flounces about the skirt. She wore a headband trimmed with silk roses, and they wobbled as she cried. Cordelia checked the address she had written down, hoping it would have changed. Alas, definitely number 30. She sighed, squared her shoulders, and approached. Pardon me, she said as she reached the steps. The girl was blocking them completely. There was no way to politely edge past. I'm here to see Anna Lightwood? The girl's head jerked up. She was very pretty, blonde and rosy-cheeked, though she'd been crying.
Who are you, then? She demanded.
Cordelia peered more closely at the girl. Definitely a mundane. No marks, no glamour.
I'm her cousin.
It wasn't quite true, but it seemed the right thing to say.
Oh.
Some of the suspicion went out of the girl's face.
I am here because, well, because it's just too awful.
Might I inquire as to the problem? Cordelia asked, though she rather dreaded finding out what it was, as it seemed the sort of thing where she might have to come up with a solution.
Anna,
the girl wept.
I loved her. I love her still. I would have given it all up for her, all of it, polite society and all its rules, just to be with her. But she has thrown me out like a dog on the street.
Now, Evangeline, drawled a voice, and Cordelia looked up to see Anna leaning out of an upstairs window. She was wearing a man's dressing gown in rich purple and gold brocade, and her hair was a cap of loose, short waves.
You can't say you've been thrown out like a dog when you've got your mama, two footmen and a butler coming for you.
She waved.
Hello, Cordelia.
Oh, dear, said Cordelia, and patted Evangeline gently on the shoulder.
Besides, Evangeline, said Anna, you're to be married Wednesday to a baronet. I don't want him.
Evangeline sprang to her feet.
I want you.
No, said Anna. You want a baronet, not to live in my messy little flat. Now go on, Evangeline. There's a good girl.
Evangeline burst into a fresh spate of tears.
I thought I was the one,
she wept.
After all the other girls, I thought they didn't mean anything.
They didn't, Anna said cheerfully, and neither did you. Do come up, Cordelia, the water's already boiled.
Evangeline let out a wail that made Cordelia jump back in fear for her life. She leaped to her feet, her blonde curls flying.
I shall not stand for this, she announced. I'm coming back in.
Anna looked alarmed.
Cordelia, please stop her. My landlady hates fusses.
There was the sound of hoofbeats pounding along the road, growing rapidly louder. A light carriage, drawn by two matched greys, hurtled up the street. A Juno-esque woman in a flared skirt and a redingote perched upon the driver's box seat. She pulled up briskly in front of the house and turned a furious face toward number 30.
Evangeline, she roared. Get into this carriage this instant.
The fire went out of Evangeline.
Yes, Mama,
she squeaked and darted into the carriage. The plumes on Evangeline's mother's hat trembled as she gazed sternly at Anna, perched in her sash window, examining an unlit cigar.
You, she shouted, you are a disgrace, breaking girls' hearts like that. An absolute disgrace, sir. If it were but a century ago, I should slap a glove in your face, decidedly.
Anna burst out laughing. The door of the carriage slammed and the horses broke into a gallop. The carriage wheels squealed as the conveyance rocketed around the corner and was soon out of sight. Anna glanced down at Cordelia pleasantly.
Do come up, she said. I am on the second floor and will leave that door open for you.
Feeling as if she had been winged by a typhoon, Cordelia made her way up the stairs and into a slightly shabby entryway. A lamp glowed in an alcove halfway up the inside steps. The rug was threadbare and the banister rail so splintered she feared to touch it, and she nearly tripped up the last three shallow steps. Anna's door was, as she had said, wide open. The flat inside was much pleasanter than Cordelia had imagined, given the state of the hallway. Softly coloured old Victorian wallpaper in dark green and gold, a haphazard scatter of furniture that didn't match but looked glorious anyway, like warring armies who had found a peculiarly harmonious peace. There was a fearsomely large sofa of worn deep gold velvet, some winged armchairs with tweedy pillows, a Turkish rug, and a Tiffany lamp of a dozen colours of glass. The mantle of the fireplace was decorated with a multitude of knives that had been stuck into it at odd angles, each with a jewelled, glittering hilt. Atop a small table by the bedroom door was a large, vibrantly coloured stuffed snake with two heads.
I see that you're examining Percival, said Anna, gesturing at the serpent. Spectacular, isn't he?
She stood in front of the sash window, looking out as the sun sank behind the rooftops of London. Her dressing gown fell open about her long body, and beneath it Cordelia could see that she was wearing dark trousers and a sheer white gentleman's shirt. It was unbuttoned to below her clavicle. Her skin was only a shade darker than the whiteness of the shirt, and her hair, curling at the back of her neck, was the same black as James's. Herondale black, the colour of the wing of a crow.
He's certainly brightly coloured, said Cordelia.
He was a love gift. I never do court dull girls.
Anna turned to look at Cordelia, the dressing gown sweeping around her like wings. Her features were not what Cordelia would ever have called pretty. She was striking. Stunning, even. Pretty seemed too small and imprecise a word for Anna.
Did that woman call you sir? Said Cordelia curiously. Did she think you were a man?
Possibly.
Anna flicked her cigar into the fireplace.
Best to let people believe what they want to believe, in my experience.
She threw herself onto the sofa. No braces held up her trousers, but unlike the men for whom they were tailored, she had hips, and the trousers hung from them, clinging close to her slight curves.
Poor Evangeline, said Cordelia, undoing the strap that held Cortana and leaning her sword against the wall.
Settling her skirts about her, she sat down in one of the armchairs.
Anna sighed. This is not the first time I have tried to break it off with her, she said. The last few times I was gentler, but as her wedding day drew near, I felt one must be cruel to be kind. I had never wanted her life ruined.
She leaned forward, her focus on Cordelia.
Now, Cordelia Carstairs, tell me all your secrets.
I think I had better not, said Cordelia. I don't know you very well.
Anna laughed. Are you always so straightforward? Why did you come to tea if you didn't want to gossip?
I didn't say I didn't want to gossip. Just not about myself.
Anna's smile deepened.
You're a vexing little thing, she said, though she didn't sound vexed. Oh, the kettle.
She leaped up in a swirl of glimmering brocade and busied herself in the small kitchen. It had brightly painted walls and a small window that looked out onto the brick facade of the building opposite.
Well then, if you want to gossip but you don't want to tell me about yourself, why don't you tell me about your brother? Is he as awful as he used to be at school?
Did you go to school with Alistair?
Cordelia was surprised. Surely Alistair would have mentioned it.
No, James and Matthew and the rest of the merry thieves did, and Matthew says he was a miserable blighter and gave them all the pip. No offence meant. I admit, Thomas never says a bad word about him.
Sugar?
I haven't any milk.
No sugar, said Cordelia,
and Anna whirled back into the parlour with tea in a chipped cup and saucer. She handed it to Cordelia, who balanced it awkwardly on her knees.
Alistair is rather awful, she admitted, but I don't think he means to be.
Do you think he's in love? Anna said. People can be awful when they're in love.
I don't know who he'd be in love with, Cordelia said. He's hardly had time to fall in love with anyone since we've just arrived in London, and I doubt everything that's happened has put anyone in a falling in love mood.
What did your father do, exactly? Anna said.
What?
Cordelia nearly spilled her tea.
Well, we all know he did something dreadful, said Anna, and that your mother's come here to try to ingratiate herself back into Shadowhunter's society. I hope everyone won't be too stiff-necked about it. I quite like your mother. She reminds me of a queen out of a fairy tale, or a peri from Lalla Rook. You're half Persian, aren't you?
Yes,
Cordelia said a little warily.
Then why is your brother so blonde? Anna asked, and you so red-headed. I thought Persians were darker-haired.
Cordelia set her cup down.
There are all sorts of Persians, and we all look different, she said. You wouldn't expect everyone in England to look alike, would you? Why should it be different for us?
My father is British and very fair, and my mother's hair was red when she was a little girl. Then it darkened. And as for Alistair, he dyes his hair.
He does.
Anna's eyebrows, graceful swooping curves, went up.
Why?
Because he hates that his hair and his skin and eyes are dark, said Cordelia. He always has. We have a country house in Devon, and people used to stare when we went into the village.
Anna's eyebrows had ceased swooping and taken on a decidedly menacing look.
People are...
She broke off with a sigh and a word Cordelia didn't know.
Now I rather feel sympathy toward your brother. And that was the last thing I wanted. Quick, ask me a question.
Why did you want to get to know me? Cordelia said. I'm younger than you, and you must know loads more interesting people.
Anna rose and her silk robe fluttered. "I must get changed," she said, vanishing into the bedroom. She closed the door, but the walls were thin. Cordelia could hear her perfectly well when she spoke again.
"Well, at first, it was because you're a new girl in our set, and I was wondering if you were good enough for our Jamie or our Matthew."
"Good enough for them in what sense?"
"Well, marriage, of course," said Anna. "Anything else would be scandalous."
Cordelia sputtered. She heard Anna laugh. She had a soft, rich laugh, like melting butter.
"You are too much fun to tease," she said. "I meant good enough to know their secrets, and Christopher's and Tom's as well. They are my special favourites, those four. You must have noticed. And, well, the current crop of girls in London is rather dire. Of course, Lucy's a delight, but she'll never look at any of the boys as anything but brothers."
"Seems sensible," Cordelia murmured, "especially in James's case."
"They need a muse," said Anna, "someone to be inspired by, someone to know their secrets. Would you like to be a muse?"
"No," said Cordelia, "I would like to be a hero." Anna poked her head out of the door and looked at Cordelia for a long time from under her dark lashes. Then she smiled.
"I suspected as much," she said, vanishing back into the bedroom. The door banged shut. "That's really why I asked you here."
Cordelia's head was spinning. "What do you mean?"
"We are in danger," called Anna. "All of us. And the Clave will not see it. I'm afraid if steps are not taken, it will be too late for Barbara and Piers and Ariadne."
There was a slight tremor in her voice.
"I need your help."
"But what can I..." Cordelia began, and broke off as she heard the downstairs front door bang open.
"Anna?"
A deep male voice echoed up the stairwell. It was soon joined by the tread of running feet, and Matthew Fairchild burst into Anna's parlour.